Hello and welcome to South Asia Chat, brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. I'm your host, Archana, and I'm a research analyst at ISAS. On 13th of July 2020, the Indian Supreme Court overturned the Kerala High Court order that the present-day Travancore royal family could not automatically step into the shoes of the previous ruler and therefore could not claim management rights over the Sri Padmanabhaswamy Temple in Thiruvananthapuram, Kerala. To discuss the Supreme Court verdict and the myths surrounding this issue, we have with us today Mr. Vinod Rai, a distinguished visiting research fellow at ISAS and a former Comptroller and Auditor General of India. There is no better person than Mr. Rai to give us insights on this issue, as he audited the temple's accounts for the past quarter of century and also submitted reports on the controversial opening of Vault B of the temple. Mr. Rai has wide experience of having worked in the Kerala state government as the district collector of Thrissur district and the financial secretary to the government of Kerala. Mr. Rai, welcome back to our show.
Thank you, Archana.
Firstly, could you briefly give our listeners a background of the Padmanabhaswamy temple and the recent Supreme Court verdict?
Thank you for having me on the podcast, Archana. This is a very interesting episode in the history of the temple, and I must say in the judicial history of India also, because this temple is unique in the sense that this is the first time that a temple is being, for management purposes, being given back to a private entity. We need to take into consideration four aspects of this temple. Firstly, regarding the history of the temple, we don't really know when exactly, but the temple finds mention in Tamil literature sometimes between 500 BC and 300 AD. But the historians in writing have recorded goings on the temple first when the Maharaja of Travancore in January of 1750 took a very major decision in surrendering the kingdom of Travancore to Lord Padmanabhaswamy. Padmanabhaswamy was the family deity of the Travancore royal family. And the then Maharaja said he was surrendering all the entire assets of the kingdom to the deity and said that they, the royal family, would continue to serve the deity as its dasa or a vassal. A vassal in some ways has been described as a slave. He says a servant has the option to quit, but we as dasas or slaves, where we don't have an option even to quit. So we continue to serve the deity forever. And since then, all the rulers of the Travancore family have called themselves Sri Padmanabha Dasas. You know? Now, in 1949, when the instrument of accession was being signed, this issue came up and the Raja agreed to the accession. Number one, Travancore and Cochin were combined. And in the accession, a specific article was introduced, Article 8, which gave the Travancore royal family and his successors the right to control and manage the Padmanabhaswamy temple, assets and everything else. So that is a specific provision in the instrument of accession. Number two, in 1950, the country decided to pass the Travancore Cochin Hindu Religious Institutions Act. Now, in this act also, there was a specific provision. Whereas the state was setting up a Devasam's board in which all minor temples were being taken up by the state, in this particular case, in the act itself, Chapter 3 of the act specifically provides or gives the right to the royal family to continue to manage this temple. So that's why I said it. Now, in 1965, that was pre the Privy Purse abolition, the then ruler, he created a trust. And he called it a public trust and handed over all the assets and the management of the trust. Though himself, he continued to be a trustee, but he handed over everything to the trust. So to that extent, in 1966, when the Privy Purses were taken away, this was being managed by the trust. But the interesting thing that happened, and that's how everything went legal, was that in 2007, an advocate was a tenant on one of the temple properties. The temple wanted to evict him and gave him notice. And that was the time when the advocate said that the present ruler, the ruler in 2007, does not have the right to do anything on behalf of the temple, because the right ended with the then ruler who signed the instrument of accession at that point of time. And that's how he went to the local court. The local court took the decision that the ruler does not have the right. He said the temple should be taken over by the government. But the royal family contested that and went to the high court, saying that they had the right. The high court also ordered that the then ruler or the descendant of the royal family did not have the right. And they said that the state must take it over and set up a committee to manage the temple. It was then, that was in 2011, then the royal family went and appealed to the Supreme Court. And now the Supreme Court, in this 13 July order, has said that no, the provision in the 1949 Instrument of Accession and the 1950 Act of Takeover of the Hindu Devism Board also specifically provided for a special relationship between the royal family and the temple, and that relationship was that of a sevaya or a manager. And the titles, losing the title in 1966 Privy Purse case, did not affect this special relationship of being a sevaya, which is only that of a manager, because in any case the temple was not the property of the royal family. The temple, the deity was the owner of the temple property. And hence the Supreme Court set up two committees. But why I call it significant is that in the committee which has been set up, the ruler or the descendant of the then ruler today, the royal family, continues to be the chairman of the advisory board. And in the administrative committee also, the court has decreed that orders will be passed only after getting the approval of the ruler to the chairman. So that, to that extent, this is an order in which a private agency or a private institution or a private family gets management control over a temple, unlike lots of other temples which have been taken. That's a specific thing about this particular temple.
Very interesting. But the judgment gives back the management of the temple to the royal family, wherein the Maharaja is merely a caretaker of the temple, as you've mentioned. But certain restrictions have been put in place currently. And how will the management be structured hereafter?
Yeah, that's a very interesting thing, because the court has mentioned that in the administrative committee, there will be a representative of the state of Kerala. There will be a representative of the union government. There will be, the administrative committee will be chaired by the district judge of Travancore, and there will also be a chartered accountant. Now, to that extent, the court has tried to put in place some checks and balances on the powers or the administrative powers of the royal family. But at the same time, that the court has said that the decisions of this administrative committee, which of course has the chief priest also as a member, will continue to be under the overall guidance of the advisory committee, which is chaired by the ruler. So to that extent, even the expenditures of the temple, if the expenditure increases rupees 50 lakhs per month or rupees 1 crore at one point of time, it has to be approved by the Travancore royal family. So to that extent, there are checks and balances, but still there has been sufficient powers which have been given the ruling family.
Okay. So one of the criticisms is that Supreme Court did not go into the fundamental rights of the religious freedom granted under Article 25 and 26 of the Constitution, since they were not raised in the Kerala High Court where this petition was first filed. Now, what are your views on this? And do you believe that the case can be challenged at a higher bench?
This is an interesting phenomenon of this particular judgment, because what was being contested in the lower court, in the high court, and again in the Supreme Court was the right of managing the temple. So to that extent, though there were interveners in the case in the Supreme Court, interveners who were on behalf of certain devotees based in Trivandrum, the court did not go into that aspect, saying that, look, this was not agitated before the High Court, and this is an appeal on the orders of the High Court, so we are not going into it. However, see, Article 25, what does it say? It only provides equality and entitled to freedom of religion subject to public order. That's what the citizens of India have been permitted. Now, this has been contested in various cases, because one of the major thing was that the Christian, All India Christian Council, had passed certain resolutions where it was felt that people felt that conversions are taking place to Christianity. Now, this was contested by three governments. One was the Orissa government, the other was the Madhya Pradesh government, and the Arunachal government, who passed laws saying that forced conversions should not be permitted. And that was upheld by the court, because the court said that whereas you have freedom to practice a religion, you have equal measure in conversion. Otherwise, there is no scope for forceful conversion. And hence, that now, similarly, Article 26. Now, Article 26 has also been contested in a very prominent case of that of the Jagannath Puri temple, where it was taken over by the state of Orissa. Now, in this particular case, what happened was the act which took over said that there is something called the Seva Puja, which is the main puja conducted in the temple. And they said that this it has two aspects. One is the secular aspect, which deals with the management and the administrative issues, and the other is a religious aspect. The court maintained that the law of takeover of the Jagannath Puri temple does not infringe the religious aspect of it. It only is takeover of the secular, which means the management aspects. To that extent, the court allowed the act to prevail in the Jagannath Puri case. Now, this if we apply to this to the Padmanabhaswamy temple also, though I feel that lots of people, lots of agencies, or lots of groups are likely to contest this, but I would personally feel that this has been contested. 25 and 26 has both been contested and found that state laws have been upheld. Though, of course, in the Sabarimala temple case, a constitution bench is going into it. It's a 9-judge bench, which will have very far-reaching consequences in its order. So let's see if this particular aspect also comes up in that hearing.
Very interesting, Mr. Rai. But if we move into the political ramifications of the judgment, would there be any demands for liberating other temples in south of India and the rest of India, for that matter, where many are being controlled by the state governments?
Yeah, yes and no on this, because, you know, I think there is a stage of flux as of now, in the sense that certain religious groups want the state laws which have taken over temples to be reversed, and they want to go to court saying that. But at the same time, even the present central government has applied for takeover of certain temples elsewhere. But I sincerely feel that in this particular case, even if any organized group goes to court for reversion of takeover of some other Hindu temple, the circumstances which apply in this particular case don't apply in the other temples. That's why I call this unique, because this is a question of the deity itself being the rightful owner and the relationship shibayatship having been established by the court itself. So I sincerely feel that the ramifications would have been there. But for example, the government of Kerala, which was contesting it and wanted it to be taken over, the government of Kerala has decided not to challenge the verdict of the Supreme Court. So they have allowed to leave it. So my own feeling is that in terms of legal aspects of the case, not very many cases will be filed, or even if they file, I don't think they will be able to withstand judicial scrutiny.
Since you have done a lot of research on institutions in India, what are your views on the role of judiciary in religious institutions particularly? Now, the Supreme Court has recently sat on a lot of high profiles, such as the Ayodhya, Sabarimala, and now we see the Padmanabhaswamy temple.
Well, yes, there have been lots of very differing opinions which have emerged in this particular thing. In fact, lots of groups have come forward say that this is a very extensive judicial overreach or judicial activism, or whatever you may call it. They have maintained that, especially in the Sabarimala case, they have maintained that it is a question of beliefs of the devotees, and those beliefs cannot be legally overridden by the Supreme Court. I have the right to worship. I have the right to of my religious beliefs, so I must be allowed to do that. But on the other hand, the argument is that it may be unconstitutional in some ways, because the Constitution permits religious rights to its or fundamental rights to its citizens. You cannot permit a government, a political setup, only by virtue of the majority that it has in a legislative assembly or in parliament, to overrule the constitutional or constitution given rights to citizens. So to that extent, I think there is a bit of a check and balance, and these takeovers, if any, I think will be continue to be subject to legal scrutiny by the Supreme Court to see whether it infringes upon the fundamental rights. To that extent, I think on the one hand, you may call it judicial overreach or tyranny. On the other hand, you have the political majority. So both can be injurious at times to fundamental rights of citizens. So I think in some ways, the court being the guardian of the fundamental rights in some ways is very healthy. And I think it should continue to be contested, especially in the Supreme Court.
And finally, we can't let you off without asking about the vaults inside the Padmanabhaswamy temple. So could you give us a sense of the wealth that can be found in there and the myth behind Vault B?
Oh, that's very interesting. That's really very interesting, because as you rightly said, there's a huge amount of myth. See, the temple has six vaults. Five of them have been opened. Vault number B, as it is called, Vault B, has not been opened. And it's believed, the deity, Lord Padmanabha, is seen in the temple to be reclining on Ananda. Ananda is the serpent, you know, and the serpent, Ananda, is protecting the Lord. That's how the deity is. It's commonly believed that Ananda protects the deity, and Ananda resides inside Vault B. There are some drawings on the doors of Vault B also, which are serpent shaped. So the mythology goes, or the belief goes, or superstition goes, that you know once they attempted to try and open it, and suddenly a whole lot of serpents came forth, and those people who were bitten, etc., happened. So the belief is that if you open that particular vault, there will ill foreboding or ill will come about. Now, the vault was attempted to be opened, but it has an outer door which was opened sometime in 2012, I believe. And it has this inner door. The then Supreme Court appointed committee could not open the inner door. It was so strong. So, I mean, Mahazar reports show that attempts have been made to open Vault B, but there is no proof and no evidence about what exactly it contains. But as regards the other five vaults, there has been a remarkable amount of wealth which seems to have come out of it. When we did the audit and the special committee was also set up, the Supreme Court specifically directed that it will not be made public, number one. Number two, no assessment would be made about the total wealth, you know. But, there have been some very delightful things which have come out. Now, two things about it. In terms of gold, if you value the wealth in terms of gold that the deity possesses, it may not be very high, 15, 20 tons of gold. The value will not be too high. But the value of the treasures of the deity is in terms of the antique value of what it possesses. Let me give you two examples. One is some very non-attractive looking, about 20 gram gold coins. And these gold coins, experts believe, are of about 3 BC, and they're Roman coins. Now, the question was to try and make an assessment of what would be the value of these coins. So this was put on the internet, three-dimensional attempts to get the auctioneers and others to value these to give us and value about this. And it was most interesting that these non-attractive looking gold coins were valued at rupees 1.75 crores each coin. Now, the Maharaja doesn't possess too many of these coins, or the deity doesn't possess too many of the coins. He possesses only about 800 of these coins. So you can quite imagine the amount of wealth. Then there is a very remarkable piece also, a replica of the deity on a 4x4 gold base or platform, you may call it, solid gold. And the replica is of black stone, just exactly as the deity is. And it's studded with all kinds of precious stones. I don't think it is evaluated because it would be a fantastic value. Then, of course, in terms of precious stones, in terms of gold ornaments, there is absolutely no end to the amount that the deity possesses, number one. Number two, in terms of pots and pans made out of gold, it can go into hundreds. So that's what the deity possesses. It's a remarkable amount. We sincerely hope that some point of time, Supreme Court will give permission to set up a small museum, because as devotees of the Lord, or Lord Padmanabhaswamy, we all hope, need to at least get an opportunity to see what the Lord possesses. So I think the mystery will continue, because even this time, the Supreme Court has not passed any direction regarding Vault B. So the myths, the superstition continues. The royal family is not in favor of opening Vault B at all, because the royal family sincerely believes, very genuinely believes, that the deity himself would not want that vault to be open. That's where we stand today.
That's very interesting, Mr. Rai. Thank you for speaking to us and also for those wonderful insights for our listeners.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. It was a pleasure.
On that note, if you wish to follow our work, please visit www.isas.nus.edu.sg. Thank you for tuning in.